ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Are you someone who thought work would be forever changed by the pandemic? And how has that played out for you? At the start of 2021, we asked experts to gaze into a crystal ball and make predictions. Because we're a little bit naughty, we dug out the tape and we invited one of our futurists back to face the music.
Always said that being a futurist is like being a weather forecaster in the sense that you can say whatever you want and be wrong and not get fired, but then all of a sudden you ask me to come back and have to listen to it.
That's Dr. Ben Hamer. In 2021, he was the lead for future work for PwC Australia. And some of his predictions will soon be put to the test. And what a good sport Ben is. And we found someone else to help us look forward. Work futurist at Atlassian, Dom Price.
Damn. We deserve it. We need to be held accountable for something.
Hello, I'm Lisa Leong. And for this working life, it's time to go back to the future. Have the lessons learned about work in the pandemic actually carried through? Let's start with workplace culture. Here's Ben Hamer.
One of the reasons why culture had improved was because we got to know each other on a more human level. We got to see into each other's living rooms all of a sudden from video calls, and people were actually checking in with their colleagues, with their team members, with a lot more authenticity. But then what happened was that all of a sudden the dial shifted and the focus went back towards profit and how do we grow out of the pandemic and how do we drive revenue. And unfortunately, we lost a lot of that human touch. And the irony to me is that as we see this wave of AI now, as we start to see more and more technology, the importance of what makes us uniquely human, those relationships, that connection, that empathy will become more and more important. And so we had it, we kind of lost it, but we're going to need to get it back.
One of the biggest changes we're all feeling back then was working from home. So let's hear what demographer Bernard Salt had to say about that in 2021.
I think at the peak of the lockdown, up to 45, even 50% of the workforce was working from home. And the big question is, does that revert back to 5%? Or does it, as I think it will, revert back to maybe 10% or even 15%?
Ben, 3 years on, where have things landed when it comes to hybrid work?
Yeah, so I mean, in terms of trying to get some hard numbers on it, it's really actually quite difficult because what we've seen over the last couple of years is commercial property companies in particular really trying to drive this narrative around coming into the CBDs, coming into the office. You know, it's never been busier because they have a very particular interest in doing that. And so there's a lot of noise out there, which means it's hard to get some firm figures. But I think what we have seen is that over the last maybe 12 months, there's been a lot of CEOs and senior leaders coming out and mandating a return to office. And so we've seen office numbers or what we call office utilization spike. But then also there's a lot of people who are actually coming in off their own accord because there is a lot of benefit to coming in and co-locating. So I would say that we are still in this state of hybrid working and that hybrid is absolutely here to stay. So hybrid being working across the home and the office. It's just that the number of days in each place has probably gone more towards the office than we expected. So from what I'm sort of seeing, hearing, and the data that's coming across my desk, I would expect that we're going into the office between 3 up towards 4 days a week. But a lot of people who have the ability to work from home are still working normally at least 1 day a week from home.
There was a bit of a hoo-ha, wasn't there, around the office mandates coming back into the office. What do you think it's done to workplace culture and trust between employers and employees?
You saw a lot of people who were trusted to work remotely because they had to during the pandemic. They were afforded that for a couple of years. And then all of a sudden it was, you need to now come back into the office because you're not productive. How do I know that you're working? I have an issue with you putting on a load of laundry in between meetings. And so it absolutely has eroded a lot of trust between leaders and their people. But the thing that I think has really frustrated me in this whole conversation about coming back into the office is that when you look at an organization's balance sheet, so when you look at their accounts and how they're spending their money, about 60% of all of their money and their expenses get spent on their people. So salaries, you know, and all the on costs that come with people, about 60%. And only about 10% get spent on office accommodation. And yet it seems like the conversation has been, well, I've got a lease. How do I get my value for money from having a lease that I've already paid for? It's a sunken cost. I want my return on investment on that 10%, rather than going, hang on, we're spending 6 times more on our people. How do we actually ensure we get the return on investment from them? How do we make sure that they're performing at their absolute best? And the data and the research shows us that if you trusted them and gave them the autonomy to pick the best environment to do the work that needs to be done, whether that's the home, the office, or somewhere else, they're not only far happier, but they are actually far more productive. We have to be a little bit more deliberate and a little bit more diligent with how we plan our working weeks, how we factor in place to that. But mandates, I just don't think are the answer. And it may have satisfied some senior executives, but I don't think it's actually had the bottom line impact that they've been looking for.
Ben says office mandates have impacted another trend that began during the pandemic, the rise of tree and sea changes. But where are things now?
That has slowed down a lot. And again, it comes back to office mandates. Back then, there was a lot more confidence that, you know, I wouldn't have to commute as much. I'd be able to work from home. Therefore, the move so far away is going to be doable. But now there's a reluctance around that purely because there's an expectation of coming into the office a lot more.
Back in 2021, you had some thoughts around a possible different way we might organise ourselves, something that you called the hub and spoke model. So let's listen to you in 2021.
There are some organisations out there who are actually looking at this hub and spoke real estate footprint. So a smaller CBD office, but then having these pop-up type collaboration hubs that are in the suburbs, which mean that I just go to the office that's closest to me and I might not be co-located with my immediate team, but I'm surrounded by a whole other group of people in my organisation. And again, that's an awesome way for sparking new and innovative ideas.
Okay, so that was you in 2021. What has happened though, Ben?
So the hub and spoke model, a version of it has taken off. And so what I mean by that is that organizations themselves haven't invested in these satellite or these suburban offices. I think a lot of them have said, you know what, we want you to come in 3 days a week. We'll let you keep working from home for, say, 2 days a week. And that's almost the compromise because the benefit of the hub and spoke model was, well, if you could go to an office that was closer to your home, that would minimize the commute. You'd be more likely to go. So they've said, no, you still have to commute all the way into the city, but we'll let you have 2 days a week from home. Compromise, we won't do a hub and spoke model. Whereas what we've also seen at the same time is the rise of co-working spaces. And these have kind of grown quite significantly in Australia and around the world, but in Australia specifically. And you've got examples of organisations that have even moved their headquarters into a co-working space as well. So Lululemon, for example, got rid of their headquarters in Melbourne. They've moved into a co-working facility, which means that their staff can come and go into that building, but they can also come and go into the other offices or work sites that co-working hub has. So a version of it exists, but organisations aren't wanting to foot the bill for that in terms of owning or leasing the accommodation directly themselves. It's more so having that pay per person per day kind of model with a co-working hub.
During the pandemic, software company Atlassian developed a way of working called Team Anywhere. It means they've been able to hire people from all over the world working remotely. But they have seen a demand for a physical space too. It led to the opening of the Melbourne Connection Hub for the 490 staff that live and work in that city. Here's Atlassian's work futurist, Dom Price.
The demand wasn't for an office. The demand was for connection. And it's funny, when we were doing our survey, we do a lot of surveying of our staff and pulsing. We're like, that C word's coming up. They're not asking for an office. It's not a desk and it's not all the normal things you associate with an office. They're like, we feel like we're missing out on connecting. So they were connecting themselves. They were hanging out in other spaces. We could see it through invoices. So you start to look at those data points. You're like, you know what? Let's do an experiment. We don't know. So this is a 12-month experiment, right? It's been open for 3 months. It's fascinating because you walk around it. It's not an office, Right, it's got, I think, like 12 or 16 desks.
So you're in a co-working location.
We've built our own co-working space.
Ah.
Right, with the sole purpose of connection, right, for serendipity, for those interjecting conversations. And it's there's a point there I want to make, which is too many people are Googling best practice ways of working ... and it doesn't exist. Right, we have to experiment our way through this and be a little bit braver and exploratory, and not enough people are willing to do that right now.
Managing collaboration and teamwork when some staff are in co-working spaces, in the office, at home, can be tricky. So how are leaders doing at managing that? Well, here's Ben Hamer with some data.
What we've seen is a study from the Australian HR Institute found that around 30% of organisations offer some kind of training to leaders and managers on how to lead and manage in hybrid, which is a really, really low figure given that so many are doing it. And so what it means is that we know, it's kind of like eating. You know that you should be eating the right foods, but you either slip up or it's too hard or you get too busy and it just sort of doesn't become a priority. So we know that we should be doing things like team agreements, that we should be having conversations around moments that matter and the days that we come into the office. What we've seen is that some organisations, some leaders have gone about doing that, but for others, either the organisation in terms of the culture, the systems, the politics has made it too challenging for them. And we have seen on, I would say, fewer occasions, but we have still seen people who have just gone back to captain's calls, which is saying, hey, I'm the boss. I want to come in on a Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, and that's the day that you guys can all come in too. So that's more the exception than the norm, but it does happen. But the advice still stands. We need to be, you know, appreciating that every team in our organisation has different kind of requirements in terms of how they need to be contacted by stakeholders, the amount of face time they have with customers. Is it a role that can be done 100% remotely or does it need to be 100% in the office? All of those considerations need to be factored in and weighed up when we think about optimizing or, you know, making sure we have the best ways of working that we can have. I still just don't think that we're there yet. And to, you know, I guess I'm being a little bit harsh, but it is really hard for leaders at the moment in terms of the environment that we're in. We've got, you know, a tightening of the purse strings. We're seeing geopolitical conflict, which is impacting supply chains. We've got a whole lot of stuff that's coming at leaders that makes it really hard to lead and manage in this environment. And so this is just one other layer of complexity that gets added to that when they've never had to manage this hybrid collaboration in the past. And so I think that's why it's kind of been put on the back burner. So I get it, but we do need to get better at it.
One thing our experts were right about in 2021 is that hybrid work in some form is here to stay. I asked work futurist Dom Price about the role of technology for collaboration in remote teams.
Here's the thing. So for collaboration to occur, there's a human element and there's a technology element. My belief, and it's classed as controversial, my belief is the technology is the amplifier. It's not the determiner of whether you collaborate or not. It will amplify what you do. So if you do good things as a human, it will amplify them. And if you do bad things as a human, it will also amplify them. So you're a fool with a tool is still a fool. You've just made them faster. And in the world of technology, certainly the last 5 years, I've seen a lot of really fast idiots. So if you want to be good at collaboration, that's a human art form of going, am I willing to share my idea with you, Lisa? And Lisa, are you comfortable enough to challenge me? Mm. If that won't happen in the real world, in the human world, that's only going to get worse in technology when I lock that document down and don't share it with you and you don't comment because you don't feel safe. So the ideas suffered. So for collaboration to occur, we need psychological safety. And that's the thing that hasn't been worked on enough in the last few years. Like the trust, the rapport to go, I like your idea, but politely, I think it might be wrong. Do you mind if I build on that? Because I think we can make it better for the customer. That doesn't happen enough in most organizations. So they have huge power in technology. They're not harnessing that power.
And how do you build that base before you then go and think about the technology and AI then? Have you got some practical examples?
The best organisations right now I'm doing it with are doing it side by side, like little small bite-sized chunks. And the weird thing is, like, I know it's 2024, it's not sexy, right? What people think is sexy is going, here's a program name, here's a project name, it's going to be 24 months, and some exec's going to cut the ribbon. But you won't hear, you won't see any progress for 24 months, and we're spending X million dollars. That's what people are wired to think, and we're going to get some consultants in to do it. They're the experts. And I'm like, maybe scrap that, maybe do it yourself, and just experiment. Get a team, so let's try as a pattern, like changing our patterns of how we work. Let's change the habits, the human behaviours. Let's amplify that with technology. Let's see what works. And if it works, let's do more of it. And if it doesn't, let's not. But it's not sexy because it's lots of small wins. It's lots of small momentum. So the best organizations I'm working with right now have signed up for evolution. No headlines with evolution because you change a little bit every day. So you don't get the headline. So your ego takes a beating. But the transformation that everyone else has been signing up for hasn't really been happening. So do we want to sign up for the headline but no net result? Or do you want to sign up for evolution and lots of small change but not get the headline?
Dom believes we need to get better at managing workplace mental health.
And we've become very content heavy. Email, Slack, Teams, like it's all FYI stuff. And we're drowning in that in our attempts to consume it because we think we need to consume all of it, the fire hose, to get an understanding. We're drowning. And then we finally get an understanding. We're like, it's too late. I'm too confused. I'm all over the shop, right? So I think what we've essentially done in work in the last few years especially is we've overwhelmed, right? We've used technology to dial up volume, not necessarily get the context that we wanted. And so people are trying to do more.
Yeah.
And in trying to do more, they're actually achieving less. We've had the opposite effect that we wanted, like good intent, badly delivered.
So if you're going to advise leaders on helping to prevent burnout and staff turnover, what would you say?
So maybe take any money you're about to spend on a mental health app, save it, look at your work priorities and make sure they're right. It's weird that we look at adding something to improve mental health. I'm like, subtract something to improve mental health. Take something away from me. Not meaningful work. I think there's a lot of people need meaningful work. They need a certain amount of stress and arousal to perform at that top level, right? There's enough science around that. I don't need to repeat that. But it's about saying, how do I give you meaningful work, but also the freedom and focus to do that properly? Versus there's an organization I was working with recently, like, after my presentation, they're rolling out their 19 priorities for the year. And I just laughed. And they were like, what? And I was like, I thought I did inner voice, but apparently I laughed quite loud. And I'm like, I didn't realize the word priorities could follow the word 19. And they're like, oh, I said, no, that's a really good point. I'm like, I don't think you have 19 priorities. I think there's just 19 things because it's not a priority anymore. So I think the danger we've got as businesses go through a lot of change and they try and do all the things a little bit well versus going, I'm going to be a bit bolder and place some sensible bets, but they can't add up to 19. I just don't think it works. So if you're doing 19 things and you're like, but it's okay because we've rolled out a mental health app, then you've abdicated responsibility is my view, right? Which is controversial, but that's my view. Versus going, if I cared about you as a group of people, I'd give you clear priorities. Clear is kind, right? Unclear is unkind. I'd give you clear priorities and then I'd give you the space and the time and the freedom and the resources and systems to deliver on that.
Okay, it's future gazing time. Let's hear Dom's predictions about where work is headed in the next few years.
So we have AI as a teammate. That's the first thing that's going to be the most confronting thing for us to deal with. The reason why it's confronting is for all my entire career, I have operated the machine. And we've thought about, is that with hands? Is it with eyes? Is it with voice? Right? We've always thought about how we operate machine, but not that machine is our equal and our peer. We've already got agents that we use internally that are AI agents that do work for me. And it's weird.
And that is the scary part, which is, well, AI is so scary. That future sounds so scary. Maybe if I bury my head in the sand, it'll go away. So what would you say to that type of reaction, whether it be from leaders, managers or individuals?
Accept it, first of all. I think I accept the reaction. It's a natural defensive reaction. I think we spend too long telling most people they're wrong. I think you're allowed your feelings. I mean, I've got nearly two-year-old boys at home, and when I think about AI, half of me is excited and half of me is petrified. And I'm okay to hold those views in my head at the same time. That's okay. I think the reality is to get over that as quickly as possible and go, how can I get an understanding of this to see how it might impact me, my family, my children, my life? And in doing that, how might it work? Or if it did work, how might it benefit me? And when you approach it with that mindset, it feels like abundance. It feels like endless opportunities. But I also say to all of those people, please keep that natural pessimism and skepticism, but embrace it at the same time.
And let's go back to the P word, productivity. Where will that be in 3 years, and where do you want it to be?
If I have my way, it's been retired, and we've replaced it with a measure. I think it might look like learning velocity, that our superpower in the next 3 years will be how quickly we can learn and adapt, not how much we can learn and adapt. And nor is it guessing what the future will be like. It's going, we don't know, so let's try and build it today, and then let's try and build it tomorrow, and let's try and build it the day after. It's those small micro changes. So I think we'll replace productivity, which is a weird output measure of units moved by hand, to how effective were we at learning. Did we learn fast? Like, if I was a CEO of a business right now, I think all I'd want to know is, am I learning faster than my competition? And if I am, I think I'll win.
And Dom's advice for workers in a time of rapid change is this.
How do I take agency over myself and my career and my life? And when you do that, you realise you have way more control than you first realised.
I think everyone's got way more control.
Way more control. So when you take that agency, you're like, cool, what are the bets I'm going to place on myself? What am I going to invest in me? And how do I do that for my betterment? That's a great, like, I'm a sole trader and I'm operating in this ecosystem. That's a great mindset.
Putting Dr. Ben Hamer back in the hot seat now. His predictions about AI, well, they're similar to Dom's, and he's hopeful the benefits will outweigh the costs.
There's a lot of negativity around AI. The robots are coming to take our jobs. I actually think there's a lot of opportunity. There's a lot of positives that come with it. And if we just go back to the start of the year when the Australian government released a study on the potential for AI, they found that it could add up to $600 billion every year to our economy if we get it right. And that's the kind of thing that I want to try and stick to and realise.
I want to talk about the makeup of our workforce. So Gen Z going to be a big part. So what do you think this means for our workplaces?
So in the next couple of years, Gen Z will occupy about 20 to 25% of all workers. And so we're going to see organisations gear up a lot towards that cohort. They're going to be looking at things like pay, career development, mental health and well-being, and flexibility as all being a really key pillar to what they're looking for from an employer. So I was actually part of a study with Officeworks last year, and we found that the younger you are, the more that flexibility becomes a deal breaker for you. So over half of Gen Z job seekers last year turned down a role that they were offered because they weren't happy with the flexible working provisions. So Gen Z will be a really key focus, and I think those four things will really characterise what they're looking for.
Do you think there's anything else that we should be aware of when it comes to the future of work, Ben?
I think if anything, when we look back over our chat 3 years ago and where we are today, and we got some stuff right, we got some things wrong, it's going to be the same when we move forwards, in the sense that the future and the future of work is not predictable. It's not a final destination that we get to and we're like, hey, we've made it to the future. And so I think this whole idea of adaptive mindset becomes so, so important. And that's this ability to learn things and learn things really quickly, but then also being able to unlearn and relearn. So not being so fixed in our points of view or in the kind of skills that we have, but that real open mindset and that willingness to learn, I think that's really going to help set people apart. And as part of that, I think there's a lot of conversation around skills, because obviously with all of this change in work, the skills we need to do our jobs are changing significantly as well. And there was a really cool study that was released by IBM last year. They've tracked the value of key skills over time and how they've changed. And if you go back to 2016, STEM skills were the number one skill that we needed to set ourselves up and be future fit. And by 2023, that had moved to the very bottom of the list because tech can do that for us or teach us. Instead, the number one skill is time management and the ability to prioritize. And then that's followed by things like communicating, working in teams, being flexible and adaptive to change. So all of those things that make us uniquely human, as more and more technology comes about, we need to focus on what sets us apart as humans, what can't be replicated by technology. And that's not what will only set us apart, but will also make sure that we are future fit for what will be the fifth industrial revolution.
Ben Hamer, thank you very much.
Thanks, Lisa.
Dr. Ben Hamer is a futurist and host of the Thinker Tank podcast. And you also heard from Dom Price, work futurist, Atlassian. What are your predictions for the future of work? Send us an email, thisworkinglife@abc.net.au. Big thanks to those of you who've sent your ideas through already. It's so fabulous to hear your ideas. Please keep them coming. And if you want to go back to the future and check out our crystal ball gazing episode from January 2021, we'll put up a link in our show notes. Next time, redundancy is part of the job cycle, no matter what level you work at. So what can we learn from those who've been through it already? Practical tips to guide you through, whether it's happening to you or someone you know. This Week in Life is on the ABC Listen app. Search for the program, tap on the pink heart so you can stay up to date with all of our episodes. I'm Lisa Leong. Thanks for listening. This program was produced by Michelle Weeks and mixed by Tim James on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in Naam, Melbourne. Until next time, work it, baby.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.